It is a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunyu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. And whenever I say that, I have this image of Bodhidharma sitting in a cave, probably facing a wall for 9 years, like he did. Bhayakuran Judith Rajier, a senior Dharma teacher in St. Paul, Minnesota, tells the story of her first experience in a zendo. So I'm going to read you her story. As a newcomer, I sat in a 5 a.m. meditation and watched the day being born. It was 1973. In the dark, I had ridden my bicycle over the Mississippi River Bridge to a section of town called Dinkytown near the university. There, in the second floor of a duplex, was a zendo in the living room where the small community sat in the early mornings. I sat down cross-legged on a zafu. I heard silence and then the first bird singing. I saw the black night turn to gray, to silver, to a light yellow. My heart and mind opened to the wonders of the day. The power of that first morning meditation still motivates me. It was my first message of hope in a dreary and painful childhood. Meeting Katagiri Roshi was a radical pivot point in my life, turning me away from wanting to die towards learning how to live. He often did that to me, turned me around and pushed me back into my life. My first private meeting with Katagiri Roshi was in a small darkened room during a sesshin. A Zen 7-day meditation retreat. He seemed very exotic to me, a short Japanese man in his 40s, wearing the full regalia of the Buddhist robes and shaved head. He spoke in a sweet, incomprehensible English. I entered my first one-on-one meeting with Roshi, my heart pounding out of my chest, and my adrenaline rushing through my veins. I made my 3 bows in the formal ritual and sat down. We sat in silence with his famous grimace of a smile. Maybe I could call it the half frown as opposed to Thich Nhat Hanh's half smile. I was very intimidated. He leaned over and said, "You can't escape pain." And then rang the bell, which was an indication that the meeting was over and I should leave. Shocked, I left the room. But, I thought, didn't the Buddha say, I teach one thing and one thing only, that is, suffering and the end of suffering. So where's the end of suffering? That's what I wanted to know. For the next decades, I misunderstood Buddhism, searching in the opposite direction of my teacher's words. I tried to transcend my human suffering. Now, after more than 40 years, I am much clearer. Trying to transcend human suffering doesn't work. The 3 poisons, greed, anger, and ignorance, arise endlessly. The pain of this truth is called the first noble truth. Human suffering is a holy truth. Spirituality is not the way out, it's the way in. In his book, Returning to Silence, Katagiri Roshi writes, suffering is not merely suffering as opposed to pleasure. Suffering is a holy truth. If this means that it is one aspect of human life from which no one can escape. And he's referring, by the way, to sickness, aging, and death. It is completely beyond what one likes and dislikes. You have to face it directly because your life is right in the midst of suffering. Directly facing the suffering as it is to be free from the suffering. As it is a little deceptive in the sense that it's true that directly facing the suffering as it is to be free from the suffering, but we're so imbued with stories and definitions and words and labels that it's very hard to directly face the suffering as it is. But he's saying directly facing the suffering as it is to be free from the suffering. It is an opportunity to touch the core of human life. This is the total acceptance of suffering. So while it is true that you can't escape pain, Buddhist practice changes the way we view our pain. If we hold it in a different way, we can change our whole perspective on life. Dogen, for example, says that suffering, its cause, its cessation, and the path to cessation, which are, quote, that's the Four Noble Truths, are all prajna, wisdom. So this is a very different perspective. And also, by the way, it's what I'm going to be speaking about right this minute will be ultimate truth. So it's very hard to grasp with our human minds. The first truth is that everything is suffering. And that includes, by the way, happiness, because it ends. So we have it, but then it ends. The second truth is that the source of suffering is our tendency to collect various elements in our minds and become attached to them, and even clinging, like possessive yearnings, can arise. That's the second truth, clinging and attachment and desires. The third truth is that it's possible to reach a cessation from such desires and suffering. And the fourth truth is that there is a path leading to such a cessation. Dogen Zenji says that all four truths are all prajna. They're all wisdom. Prajna means wisdom. He says that suffering as it is, remember that as it is trick, is prajnaparamita, the perfection of wisdom. The covetous desires that cause suffering are, as they are, prajnaparamita. Suffering is a condition in which problems come toward us and we feel uneasy. Suffering is a condition. Suffering is just suffering. We just suffer. People may think that they can be released from mental suffering through Buddhist practice, but they cannot be released from physical pain, no matter how much they practice. When there is pain, we must just be with the pain. When there's suffering, we must just face the suffering. And there's that phrase, this, just this. We can do nothing else. And when we stay entirely present with this, just this, that, Dogen is saying, is the perfection of wisdom. And we can do nothing more. So it's the now part. Do you see? It's the now, staying totally present with an unadorned now. Whatever happens, even during Zazen, That is prajna, or wisdom, or emptiness, or enlightenment, or whatever you want to call it. It needs to be unadorned, which means by thoughts, names, labels, opinions, preferences, and it needs to be now. That is reality. Actual reality itself, even though we can't with our minds grasp ultimate truths or ultimate reality, it helps to know what they are, what these truths are. Mental agony is the same. As long as we are living beings, we'll have various thoughts, and they well up constantly with an irresistible force. And contrary to what is commonly thought about the condition of our minds in Zazen, there is no time when we have no thought or no mind. There is no time. Following conditions such as temperature, humidity, and nutrition, various thoughts arise. So we have conditions. Troubles come from taking actions based on such thoughts. Rather, we can do this, just this, that is, stay with now, cut the thoughts, and bring ourselves back to now. And it's the constant action of bringing back that's important. It's the bringing back. So, and Zazen gives us lots of practice with that, you know, that constantly bringing your mind back to what you've decided is the point of concentration. And if it's your breath, you inhale, you exhale, count one, you inhale, and you're already thinking something, and you bring it back, your mind back, and then you inhale and exhale, count one again, and so forth. And even that's what you do for 30 minutes. Zazen is over, and that's an absolutely fine Zazen. So in whatever situation, if we are this, just this, every instance is prajnaparamita. And so the now, when you're in pain or when you're bored, you can remind yourself this, just this, and there's nothing else. I find this very helpful. Katagiri Roshi writes, sometimes people think that Zen practice is a bridge between suffering and happiness. We practice first and then we'll be happy. But practice and happiness are not separate. Practice is not a bridge. Practice itself is joy. Practicing egolessness doesn't mean that you destroy yourself and then something changes in the future. It means that egolessness comes up simultaneously with the activity of practice. When subject and object are merged into the present moment, we are encouraged to let go of our interpretations, in Buddhism, they're considered add-ons. Without the add-ons, grief becomes grief, loss becomes loss, and we have the comfort of holding them with universal perspective. So it's not just my grief, that everyone suffers in this way. Bhayakiran Judith Rajir says that suffering, actually dukkha, the word in Sanskrit for suffering, actually translates as space. And this can imply a sense of being apart from the perfect and the complete. In this way, dukkha conveys the deepest anguish and dilemma of the self. We interpret ourselves in a state of separation from the whole. And this sense of a separated self is the beginning of the misunderstanding of life. It's the beginning of our feelings of alienation and despair. And it's also wrong. It's all wrong. Although our experience is nothing but a cavalcade of fleeting momentary events, we take ourselves to be discrete, autonomous individuals. In other words, we mistakenly believe that there is some kind of me or self that experiences these dharmas and provides coherence and an underlying unity, and that those heaps of experiences make up some kind of independent me. Although that in itself might not be much of a problem, what inevitably happens is that we cling to these and to the self we imagine to be experiencing them. We cling to what we perceive as I, me, and mine. We try to preserve, protect, and promote that imagined self, and then we suffer. Dissatisfaction. So another translation of dukkha or suffering is dissatisfaction. And if we use this one, it means both satisfaction and dissatisfaction. Because if we're wise, we see that satisfaction quickly changes to dissatisfaction. There is a continuum of pain, starting from small dissatisfactions to great pains of loss, failure, sickness, and death. As soon as we get up in the morning, something already goes wrong. This is the way the human mind works without training. The underlying vibration of dukkha, our suffering, comes from the perpetual desire from our own personal pleasure in life, a child's voice of I want what I want and I want it now is still in many of us. So notice that she says without training. Training means mind training. Zazen is one example, but we can work on this throughout the day by interrupting our stories, projections, discriminations, fantasies, and bring our minds back to the point of what we're doing. Mind training basically means concentration. We train ourselves that when we put our minds on something, it stays on that thing. So it doesn't wander all over, thinking of the past and the future and our desires and disappointments. It just stays put. So doing the dishes is a good daily life opportunity to practice this, for example. Practice, you're concentrating on the dishes and then your mind goes, then you bring your mind back, bring your mind back. And as we begin to change how we perceive our life, we begin to understand that there is no solid self. And with this adjustment in thinking, our relationship to our suffering does start to change. We begin to acquire what Katagiri Roshi calls spiritual stability, a place in ourselves that is quiet, connected to everything, and beyond personal identity. This provides us with an inner strength and resilience to see the real truth of the world. As we find this place in ourselves, our obsession with our problems seems to calm down, and we begin to practice with things as they are. As we begin to work with what causes our suffering, we can find what releases our suffering. For example, seeing pain as pain and not my pain. When we think that the pain is connected to all humans, it becomes a doorway to humanity. Learning how to stay with negative emotions and not turn away is one of our essential practices. Zazen is a laboratory in which we discover and find out how to stay with our negative emotions. And we learn acceptance in our meditation practice. And as we do this, we can begin to extend our life, extend ourself into our life activities. Here are some short, easy to remember lines that can help us stay with this teaching. You can just remember the line, and then when you think of the line, you think of the whole teaching. So it's kind of a neat sort of teaching device in a way. So here are three. May I fully face life and death, loss and sorrow. That's a good one. May I fully face life and death, loss and sorrow. May I accept my suffering, knowing that I am not my suffering. I like that one the best, I think. May I accept my suffering, knowing that I am not my suffering. May I be present and stay open to pain. It's very simple. But if you say during the day, you know, may I be present and open to pain, it brings back the gist maybe of everything I just said. And from Thich Nhat Hanh, my dear suffering, I know you are there. I am here for you and I will take care of you. It's very heartfelt. In Buddhism, we stay with the energy of the suffering of life when it arises. Each emotion, each bit of human suffering is expressed as an energy in the present moment. If we can remain with that energy, we are receiving our life. The practice of returning to now stabilizes us. We find a different kind of space, which is open, peaceful, and timeless. This refuge has the effect of reducing our suffering. There is a strong connection. Listen carefully to this sentence. There is a strong connection between the radical acceptance of our suffering and the development of compassion. You can see that, right? If we fully enter each instance of pain, we will know what that feels like. We fully enter it and we'll know what it feels like. And then we feel for others who experience it. Oh, I know what that feels like. Ugh. I'm really sorry they have to go through that. Like that. Thich Nhat Hanh writes, because there is suffering in your heart, it is possible for you to enter the Buddha's heart. Your suffering and my suffering are the basic condition for us to enter the Buddha's heart and for the Buddha to enter our heart. So that's the first noble truth, the truth of suffering. The second noble truth, the cause of our suffering, is that we cling to a personal desire system. That is desire, clinging, grasping, attachment, craving, thirsting. Its nobility comes from knowing that we can't extinguish it. We know we can't extinguish it. Buddhism doesn't ignore desire or try to destroy it. We practice with it, though our attachments cause our problems. We learn to pivot around them and use them for the benefit of others also. Our desires come from holding on to what we think will produce happiness for ourselves. But part of the work in Buddhism is to deconstruct a solid sense of self. We redirect ourselves to the teaching of interdependence, which makes ourselves more porous. Otherwise, if we believe in the singular self, we have to defend it and try to grasp what the self thinks it needs. This is what is called a personal desire system, built around a self and its imagined needs. I think this is a neat concept. Calling it a personal desire system makes that part of our interior life into its own little dynamic, which if we can define and monitor, we can interrupt. It gives us more control. Consciousness always gives us more control. But this too is a kind of mind training. So the whole mind training our minds, is like the beginning of, you know, any kind of progress on this path of Buddhism. And this is one kind of mind training. Defining and monitoring our personal desire system, and we all have one. So the third noble truth is that our personal desire system can be released. We actually can let it go. And Katagiri writes on cessation, it's called cessation. In a moment, and he's talking about Zazen, you can go beyond the phenomenal world of time and space to the source of time, where your life is calm and stable and your activity is clear and pure, when there is no self-consciousness. It is called Bodhi or enlightenment. Our Dogen is calling it Prajna or wisdom. Bodhi mind is freedom. Bodhi mind is freedom. It is the function of mind. This is Katagiri Roshi. It is the function of mind that is beyond dualistic consciousness. But to arouse Bodhi mind, we have to use our discriminating human mind. To arouse Bodhi mind, we have to use our discriminating human mind. In other words, the Buddha's mind is beyond human consciousness, but the only way to find out what it is through human consciousness and through our conscious activity. That's why we practice. And in addition to Zazen and mind training, in addition to both of those, outside of Zazen, we can, what's called, plant seeds of virtue. Doesn't that sound nice? We can plant a seed of virtue. What does it mean to plant a seed of virtue? Well, our practice is to bring forth a seed of virtue each time a poison arises. Poison means greed, anger, and ignorance. So in a moment of, you know, I want to eat the whole box of cookies right now. You can plant a seed of virtue. And no matter the size, we can plant a seed of virtue right in the middle of our likes and dislikes. And these seeds of virtue are, this is what they are. Any spiritual concept, like, you know, any spiritual concept, generosity. I think I'll give the rest of the box of cookies to my neighbor. Or quality that may help the situation, such as kindness, patience, clarity, changing a habit, bringing forth a soft heart, reconnecting with universal energy, and opening up to something larger than our concept of self. Actually, this can be kind of fun, actually. You think, if you can remember to think, I'm going to plant a seed of virtue. And you can make up what your seeds of virtue are beforehand. Have them in a box in your mind to pull out. Katagiri Roshi said that at the bottom of suffering, you will find emptiness. Bhayakuran Judith Rajir says, at the bottom of your suffering is a door. That door opens and you see Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion. Avalokiteshvara can embrace you, and then you can dissolve and become Avalokiteshvara yourself. So this is how suffering turns into compassion. You become Avalokiteshvara yourself by opening the door and entering your suffering. There's one more piece here that Reb Anderson Roshi adds that I think is just so wonderful. I think I'm so highly of all of his teaching. It's very poetic and very moving and just spot on. So this is the further suggestion. He says, one of the most famous chants in the Zen tradition ends with a vow to taste the truth of the Buddha's words. A vow to taste the truth of the Buddha's words. Reading the great sutras, or hearing our teachers explain them to us, is a rare and amazing event. Having them to listen to, accept, and remember is wonderful. But sometimes when we hear the truth, we don't necessarily taste it. And according to this chant, it is actually possible to taste it in our body. Even as we walk around and live our daily lives, we can remember what we heard, and we can taste the truth of those words in the deepest parts of our being. When we do that, the Buddha's teachings take over our body and mind, and we become one with the teaching. Each of us needs to develop and cultivate our own way of tasting these teachings. It helps to keep reminding ourselves how rare and amazing it is to be present for them. Consider how many people who have never heard of Buddhism, not to mention Zen, or could care less. Our karma, just in being here and being present for hearing what the Buddha taught, is mysterious and amazing, as Reb said. The fourth noble truth, the Eightfold Noble Path, will engage us for the rest of the seminar. So there's no need to go into it today. Here are some of the most important points from today's talk. First, trying to transcend human suffering doesn't work. The three poisons, greed, anger, and ignorance, arise endlessly. The pain of this truth is called the First Noble Truth. Human suffering is a holy truth. Spirituality is not the way out, it is the way in. In a way, that's the whole talk. That's so profound. But second, another important point from today's talk is directly facing suffering as it is to be free from the suffering. It is an opportunity to trust, to touch the core of human life. This is the total acceptance of suffering. Third, Buddhism doesn't ignore desire, nor try to destroy it. We practice with it. Though our attachments cause our problems, we learn to pivot around them and use them for the benefit of others also. Fourth, part of the work in Buddhism is to deconstruct a solid sense of self. We redirect ourselves to the teaching of interdependence, which makes ourselves more porous. Otherwise, if we believe in this singular self, we have to defend it and try to grasp what the self thinks it needs. This is called a personal desire system built around a self and its imagined needs. Fifth, there is a strong connection between radical acceptance of our suffering and the development of compassion. And finally, sixth, even as we walk around and live our daily lives, we can remember what we heard and we can taste the truth of those words in the deepest parts of our beings. When we do that, the Buddha's teachings take over our mind and body, and we become the teaching. Here are some ideas to reflect on during the week. First, Katagiri's words, "You can't escape pain." Do you believe this? Describe some occasions when you've tried. It's very important to be sure of this point. So that's the first idea to reflect on during this week. Do you believe Katagiri's words, "You can't escape pain"? And when you've tried, think of those times when you've tried and what was the outcome of when you've tried. It's really important, this point, that you're sure of where you stand on it. Second, directly facing the suffering as it is to be free of the suffering. Does this idea frighten you? You may in truth be too afraid to try it. Just directly entering the suffering, It's a big one. And if that's the case, if you are too afraid to try it, can you speak about this? And if it's not the case, can you try doing it? You'll probably have an opportunity today. Third, There is a strong connection with the radical acceptance of our suffering and the development of compassion. And it has been shown that the opposite also seems to be true, that our expanded use of electronic devices has decreased the empathy of college students, for example, by 40% over the last 30 years. Electronic devices remove us from ourselves. Accepting our suffering goes in exactly the opposite direction. Fourth, with reference to the idea of planting a seed of virtue, please make a list of what that would look like in your life. Remember, these are small actions or thoughts, though if you're changing a habit, it's a large action. Changing a habit is really hard. And remember, it takes 3 months of every single day setting down a new neural pathway. The more you make them conscious, however, your habits, the more you make them conscious, the more power such a gesture will hold. And fifth, sometimes when we hear the truth, we don't necessarily taste it. And are you that person? Can you experiment consciously with tasting it? Those are five ideas to even pick one and really, really think about it and make it your own, just like you take it and you really kind of empty it out, you know, make it your own. I wonder if there are questions.
So, Gail, the first one that we have is, can you give us an example of how an attachment can be used for the benefit of others?
So I'm attached to reading. When I was a little girl, all of my friends were characters in books. And I'm very attached. I'm very attached. There's a level in which it's still that way. Not that my only friends, but I'm very attached. And so now I read Buddhism every night, and then I can turn it around. I pivot it around and teach others help others learn about Buddhism and what's so amazingly special about it. And I don't see them as my teachings really, but hopefully you can use them to change your life for the better. So that's one example, but also the whole world of addicts who recover and then can help. They're especially good at helping others recover from that same addiction because they know all about it. They know all of the covers of it, and they just know everything. So that's a really good example of using an attachment, or in the example of addiction, it's even more than attachment, for the benefit of others. Thank you, that's all.
Thank you, Gail. So the next one is, what does noble mean?
I'm really glad this question came, because every time I use that word, I have the feeling that it's giving the wrong impression. It doesn't mean noble as in the king, you know, or nobility or any kind of hierarchy of class or anything like that. Actually, it means the truth as perceived by Arya beings, A-R-Y-A. Arya beings are those who have had an experience of direct realization of emptiness or selflessness. So they're basically enlightened beings. They're called Aryas. And Arya beings, noble means something seen by an Arya being as really being. So it's something that an Arya being sees as real. And in this case, it's the Four Noble Truths, the truth of suffering, of the causes of suffering, of the cessation of suffering, and the path that leads to the cessation of suffering. We ordinary beings can't see these truths clearly because we lack the direct realization of the nature of reality. But Arya beings have had the experience of a direct realization of the nature of reality. And according to Arya beings, these truths are so, and so they're called noble. They're noble because they're definitely true in the ultimate truth sense. Thank you.
So the next one that we have is, I loved what Reb said about tasting the truth. These teachings are really hard, and sometimes I feel the words sort of wash over me like water says so. I've heard them, but that's all. Do you have any suggestions about how to make them sink in?
I like this. So I do it on the, you know, I don't know if you have to have the experience of the new meters on freeways, and you sit in a long line just waiting to get on the freeway, and then you sit on the freeway. So there you are in your car. It's this. That's all there is in the whole world. This, just this. And it may never, you know, you don't think about it ending. It's this, just this. That's very helpful. I just use it all the time. And those lines I gave you, they're one-liners that you can memorize in like a second. And it brings back the kind of, at least general force of today's talk. And the one I like the best is, may I accept my suffering, knowing that I am not my suffering. May I accept my suffering, knowing that I am not my suffering. This isn't, this is just suffering. Suffering is just suffering. That's the truth. The truth is unadorned. Suffering is just suffering. It doesn't have any stories about it. It's just what it is. And also, Zazen helps enormously because the real truth is that we understand these teachings with our body. And when we're sitting, they sink in, even though we're not aware of it, they sink in. And they sink into our bodies. And so doing Zazen, even if you don't think you're getting anything at all, which, and anyway, that's not the point, the truths are sinking in. So that's another way. You might make up your own one-liners also that help you remember teachings, maybe not even today's teachings, but other teachings. Just make up your own one-liners. They're phrases that that are like teaching devices for yourself. You can make up your own self-teaching devices, which is a phrase that stands for a whole bunch of concepts. That's all.
Thank you, Gail. So there's like a follow-up comment that we got on a previous question. And it says, alternatively, I've heard the words noble truths also translated as ennobling truths. This has been helpful to me.
Thank you. That's super helpful. I can really see how, that's kind of how I experience them actually, as ennobling truths. I mean, it's nice to know that the Arya beings have, you know, given their pass on it, but it's really nice to know, to think of them as ennobling. And, you know, there's another way also of thinking of it as upright or correct. That's another, I think that's the way I've been thinking of it all along until I've gotten to this part of the literature, as they're noble because they're, when I'm using the word upright, it's kind of the way being upright, there's the title of one of Reb's books, being upright and the correct way of being in the world, that's sort of as noble as being upright. So thank you very much.
So another comment that we have is, I'm noticing that the Buddha was extremely psychological, even in the ordering of the four truths.
He absolutely was on purpose. So in terms of the order, the Buddha taught the truths very specifically, not in the order in which things arise in reality. So instead, he used an order that represents the way each truth is psychologically established within us. For example, when we start to work with the first two noble truths, it's natural that we first realize that there is suffering, you know, there is. And then the realization then leads us to search for the cause of that suffering. And it's the same with the second set. We see that there is suffering and that it has an origin. And then the next step is to say, is there any way out? And then in so doing, we establish, say, yes, there is a possibility for cessation. And then, of course, then we look for, okay, what do we do? And that's what the Eightfold Path tells us, what we do. So it was very clever. I find comfort just in the idea that the Buddha was psychologically minded. I mean, you know, I'm sort of into psychology, and it's nice to know the Buddha was psychologically minded. Not everybody is. I think we don't, unless there's a very short question, I don't think we have time for another question.
So there is one that we just got. The word suffering seems to have many different meanings in these teachings, from dissatisfaction to pain to existential angst. Does happiness balance out all this suffering? Does Zen try to find a balance between suffering and happiness?
No. Zen practice is considered happiness. There's not two things. There's just practice, really. There is just practice, and that's all. And the practice itself absorbs. Actually, Suzuki Roshi used to teach us at the San Francisco Zen Center. The Zendo was in this big basement in a not very good neighborhood. And he taught us that just sitting, Zazen, was absorbing the suffering of the neighborhood, all the pain in the neighborhood. I maybe he didn't use the word all, but the pain that we could, you know, hear gunshots in the neighborhood, by sitting in Zazen, we were absorbing. I think the word suffering covers all kinds of suffering, even if it's just a little, the little, since everything changes every nanosecond, it can turn into major suffering. So I can't give an example, but this morning when I got to my car, one of my tires was flat. And then this isn't suffering, but it's a lot of, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? And then the trouble it causes other people to help me. And it's still, of course, not over. The car is sitting there and has to be taken care of. So, I mean, I was just coming here. And then all of a sudden. So anyway, before I end, I want to be sure to thank Brendan and Sahar and Brian, who work so hard to make these talks possible. I'm so grateful. And I hope I will see you next week. And bye for now.